For this evening's Dharma talk, I'm responding to one of the emails which I get from time to time. Well, I don't get it sent to our society here, because if I had an email address, there'd be even less chance to meditate, even less chance to sleep. But the email which was sent to our society asked me to talk some more about what we call in Buddhism right view. It is part of the Eightfold Path, but more than that, it is part of the foundation of Buddhist practice. What do actually Buddhists believe, or rather, what is their view? How do they go about things? What is the framework for their lives? And this is the subject of right view. But it needs to be emphasized, first of all, that right view, you can call it a set of beliefs or dogmas, but it's not so much a belief but a framework for finding out. And as many people ask, how do we know that it's right view rather than wrong view? Because everyone believes they're right. And it's an observation which even came from Socrates, who was apparently said that everyone always believes they're right. And it's an interesting little thing to contemplate that it is psychologically impossible to think you are wrong about anything. You may think you were wrong, but at the time, even when you think you're wrong, you think you're right about that. So if you really look at it, whatever idea, concept we have, we always believe that it's right in that moment. And this is one of the problems with the diversity of human opinions and views and dogmas and beliefs, that everyone believes they're right, even though there's a diversity of completely contradictory ideas. So what is actually the right in the word right view? And one of the teachings which really meant a lot to me when I was a young Buddhist, which really gave me an inspiration and also a means to separate out those types of ideas which were not going to be helpful and from those which were helpful, was a saying of the Buddha that whatever is right view, whatever is truth, whatever is the teachings of the Buddha, you can know them by their results. They should turn you away from some of the bad things like attachments. They should actually make you more dispassionate, more free, more peaceful, more still, more liberated. And it's because of those are the qualities by which we can know that it is a right view or not. Simply by its results in our own internal life, in our family, in our community, in our world. And it's a wonderful little test to see what is right view and what is wrong view. Because even in Buddhism, people can have these ideas and views and they can go and argue with each other and they can get quite upset with each other. And unfortunately, in Buddhism, we don't have wars, but still people can have quite vigorous arguments, especially if they've drunk too much coffee. Which actually shows where the arguments really come from. Nothing to do with Buddhism, just too much caffeine. But the point of the point I'm trying to make here is that it's where these ideas and views lead to shows you whether it's a right view or a wrong view. And of course that brings me up to something very topical about the cartoons, which I was just come back from New Zealand talking a lot about the cartoons, the Muhammad cartoons, which was causing a huge amount of problem in the world. And that's a very good example there of how that cannot be right view to go on such violent, aggressive demonstrations about a cartoon and to be offended so easily. And it's one of the problems which I see with religions in the world. We do get offended so easily. And one of the reasons why religions get offended so easily is because they forgot the heart of their religion. The right view should be, if it's a real religion, a real truth, a proper view, it must always be something which creates not more turmoil in the world, but which actually solves and settles disputes, which brings more peace, not just in your own life, but peace between peoples, between genders, between sexual orientations between religions. And that's actually what we know is like right view. There is views which do create peace, which create harmony, which lessen tensions and create more friendship and love and harmony in this world. And whatever those views are, that is called right view. And an example of that, with the cartoons, I mentioned this earlier, a few months ago, when they had the problem with the Quran down the toilet. Remember what I said? If anybody ever flushed a copy of a Buddhist holy book down the toilet, should always call a plumber. That's the Buddhist response. But certainly, you should never get upset and start a war or start violence. Because, the whole scripture, the whole teachings of all religions are all supposed to be encouraging us to be peaceful. So we're forgetting what the book is actually encapsulating. It's the same with our religions. The word which I usually use these days is we confuse the container with the contents. The container might be the book. The container just might be a statue of a Buddha, and you can destroy Buddha statues, but you never allow Buddhism to be destroyed. Because Buddhism is not the metal. Buddhism is the peace, the forgiveness, the compassion, sort of the non-violence which a statue signifies. The content may be sort of the statue, but it's what it signifies is more important. So as somebody first, when I went to the first global conference on Buddhism, we're having our fourth global conference in June. If you haven't booked up yet, please book up, because actually you learn a lot of things from these conferences. And what I learned from the first conference was when I think people were starting Buddha bars, or they were having advertisements with Buddhas on women's lingerie and all sorts of other stuff, that people were upset. Were you offending Buddhists or not? And one fellow, I think, from the United States came up and said, no, it's impossible to offend Buddhism. And he made a very good point. This is what I learned from these conferences. I learned that, the message, the right view of Buddhism is, how can you get offended? Because being offended by itself is wrong view. It's missing the point. It's missing the point that whatever people say or do, that is their karma. Our karma is to be peaceful, to be forgiving, no matter what someone says. And we always just let it go. And you've heard this many times. It's in books like my book, Open the Door of the Heart. It's just in basically self-help manuals. If everyone ever calls you a dog, you don't get offended. You look at your bottom to see if you've got a tail. And if you haven't got a tail, you're not a dog. End of story. It makes life very easy. And Buddhists are great with these strategies. So we just refuse to get offended. And when you refuse to get offended, you always come up trumps. There's a story in that book which is told us in Adelaide. Not in Adelaide, sorry, in Wellington, New Zealand, where I just came from. The story of that soldier in the Vietnam War, close to my monastery in northeast Thailand, a U.S. Air Force man coming from the base into town on a cycle rickshaw. Halfway on the journey, he passed a bar where many of his friends were getting drunk, as his passenger was this big black Afro-American soldier. And because his friends were getting drunk, they shouted out, "Where are you taking that filthy dog to?" pointing at the U.S. soldier. And that would have been a fight if the soldier had understood Thai. But the soldier was just looking around, enjoying the scenery with a smile on his face. The driver thought the guide doesn't understand Thai, so decided to have some more fun. And pointing to his passenger in the back, he said, "I'm taking this filthy, dirty mongrel, throwing him in the river in town for a good wash." And everybody laughed, except the soldier, who just was peacefully enjoying the ride. And when they got to town, the soldier got out of the rickshaw and started walking away without paying. And when the rickshaw driver shouted out after him, "Now where's my money, my fare?" the soldier turned around and said in perfect Thai, dogs don't have money. Now that's how we deal with offence. You can see now that's an example of right view, because that actually doesn't create any arguments, any fights, and it also saves you a lot of money. So like right view is something which solves the problems of the world, which doesn't create new problems. So you can always know right view and also the right speech and right actions by its results. If it does create more turmoil, more anxiety, just more separation between people, you've obviously not seeing it right. There's always other ways to deal with the problems of life. And one of the troubles is that sometimes when we have stories like this, people try and imitate them, and it never works. It's not the story which you should imitate. Now, it is the meaning behind it. The story also is like a container. It's a contents. What's really important, what's contained in these stories. And this is actually what we mean by right view. You can talk about words and theories like reincarnation or karma, but it's actually what this holds inside of it. That's the essence, the meaning. And if you understand the difference between the container and the contents, or the other simile we use in Buddhism, the signpost and where the destination, the map and the territory, you know those differences, then you'll never get confused between the dogma and the right view. A dogma, whether it's the Buddhist scriptures, whether it's a story which you hear from monks like myself or Sister Wayama, or which you read about Ajahn Chah, or the books, or the Buddha statue, or all the rituals and the stuff which we do in this temple, these are never to be confused with the contents. Once you understand that, it's easy why we can't be offended. How can you be offended? You know, well, what people say about you as a monk, what people say about you as a person, as a wife, as a husband. Because it's only when we forget that it's the peace of harmony which is the most important thing. And then we decide, no, if peace and harmony is the most important thing, that's what I'm going to keep in my heart. That's what I'm going to make most important. Even as a kid, you used to say, sticks and stones break my bones, words will never hurt me. But these days, people just forget about things like that. So it's great to have a teaching which separates out what real right view is from dogma. And we know it's right view because it creates peace and harmony and freedom in our world. We know the signposts, we know where it's pointing to. So actually, what is this sort of type of right view, which actually leads to peace and harmony? Again, it's the priorities of what's really important in life, but it's also understanding that each one of us, when we go to the idea of karma and rebirth, the idea of karma is each one of you is responsible for your own actions. You are in charge, which means you don't have to be always manipulated by like the bad words of other people or by their actions. When you understand the law of karma, it means you are responsible. You make your own karma. As it says in the Buddha, that you are the owner of your karma. What it means is that no one can actually upset you unless you let them upset you. No one can make you angry. You only allow them to make you angry. No one can make you depressed. You allow life to make you depressed. The law of karma is actually showing that you, in this sense, are in complete control of your destiny of life. Not other people, and certainly not any other supreme being. If you believe that you are a victim of your husband or your wife, your ex that is, or of your job, of your sickness, your cancer, your old age, or whatever else happens to you, if you think as a victim, it means you've got no freedom to make something out of whatever happens to you in life. You think that you have to be sad, you have to be upset, you have to be traumatized. And one of the wonderful things about this right view of the law of karma is it shows that you are completely free to make something out of whatever happens to you in life. I go back to the story of my own father. He was a victim of child abuse, as many, many people were. He always used to talk to me about his father, my paternal grandfather. He always used the word, please excuse me, bastard, to my grandfather. And the reason was that my paternal grandfather, born in Liverpool, rather my father born in Liverpool, my paternal grandfather, I think, was also born in Liverpool, a very poor plumber before the Second World War. His lifestyle was just so grim, hopeless, that almost every evening after work he would go to the pub, get drunk, come home, and just take off his belt and beat any kid who came in his path for no reason whatsoever, and then start on his wife, my paternal grandmother, my father's mother. It was domestic abuse, which was not uncommon. But the point was that you'd expect a person who had such abuse visited on him every day, who saw his mother being, you know, basically whipped every day, would be a victim and have great psychological problems and would be a terrible father to myself and my brother. But the opposite happened. Even though he was in that terrible childhood of poverty, of violence, which they're not much love at all, that he, I remember him telling me once, said when he was on the end of the belt, he made a resolution if ever he had children, he would never, ever do that. When he realized how bad it was, he actually learned from that and became one of the most kind and loving fathers you could imagine. Now, what the point of that story is that you are never a victim of your circumstances. The right view of karma is telling you that, yeah, it's a tough one to deal with when you're a subject of domestic violence or childhood abuse. But it is possible. People do it. You don't need to allow that to stop your growth as a human being, to prevent your freedom and to inhibit your ability to love, to grow, to be wise, to be compassionate. The law of karma, as it says, gives you that freedom. What it means is that you can never really be a victim unless you really want to be a victim, unless you allow yourself to be a victim, unless you believe you're going to be a victim. The law of karma empowers you. And this was one of the great teachings which I respected so much. Instead of complaining about your situation, instead of complaining, I've got cancer, I've just lost my child, I've just lost my job, whatever it is, there's always something one can do about the situations which life throws up at you, which actually shows why it is a right view, because that attitude will lead to peace, to freedom, to harmony. If you're always a victim and think you're a victim, then the problem lies with somebody else or with the situation or with God or with somebody else, and you always stop your own response system from growing. You just give up and hope someone else will fix up the problem for you, or you will fix them up as revenge. It's their fault. It's somebody else's fault. Now, this is actually the wrong view. The right view is something which leads to peace, harmony, growth, freedom. And, of course, the law of karma, when it means that you take responsibility for your actions, it's no one else's fault. If someone does a cartoon about Ajahn Brahm, or whatever it is, that I can choose not to be offended. It's a wonderful thing when you actually take that responsibility and that freedom not to be offended. Because when you take that power, then you do become stronger. People can say things about you. They can do things about you. You refuse to be offended, which means a lot of time people don't act like that anymore. They don't push your buttons. When people stop, you don't get angry when they sort of get upset about you. They stop getting angry at you. It is true that we've been here 22 years in this city since I first came here. When I first came here, people would always try and abuse you as a Buddhist monk. They'd always try and stir you up, you know, with statements such as, you're dressed like a girl, why don't you get a proper job, or you're old enough to know better. Which is, you know, a common idea for Buddhist monks, because people didn't know who you were. And when anybody would shout offence, they'd make a point never to react, never to get upset. Why would I allow other people to control my happiness by these words which people shout out? And of course, that if you allow people to control your happiness, remember that time when I gave a sermon at St. George's Cathedral and they had these two guys outside? There was a guy and a girl or something who were saying that the monks were filth, they were evil, they were leading people down the wrong path into hell. They were the born-again Christians who were basically shouting themselves hoarse, but they were being completely ignored. And what a wonderful response that is. Instead of going up and arguing or sort of saying that you're more evil than I am. No, no, you're the more evil. No, 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 you're the more evil. Than having a fight. When you don't allow people to control your happiness, they can actually shout as much as they like, and the whole thing finishes. There's a wonderful thing about the passivity of Buddhism, which comes from right view, is that we just keep going on and on, growing, 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 without needing to make a big fuss and bother, without needing to say, we want to protect our rights. We don't need to do that. By empowering every individual just to be who they are, to value peace rather than any dogma, we're actually creating these wonderful causes for growth in the world. Right view is what leads to such growth, to peace, to harmony. So it's the same when you're like in a relationship. If it is really right view, it should lead to more peace and harmony. So when people come here and they say, ever since I became a Buddhist, my relationship has gone on the rocks, then I think, what type of Buddhism are you practicing? Because if you really understand these teachings, you should be a much softer, gentler, more beautiful husband. You should be a much more tender, caring, sensitive wife. Isn't it that what I'm saying, right view, is what leads to peace and harmony? But my goodness, you know, you've got to live with your wife. You've got to live with your husband. So surely, can't you make a better job of it? And so, right view is also, for example, learning how to speak in appropriate ways. Ways which lead to peace and harmony in the world. So we can actually use our speech in ways which are conducive to our own benefit and the benefit of all other beings. So it's amazing just how harsh people's speech is. And sort of kill all the Westerners or whatever, you know, those fanatics were saying, or blow up something. And then what does that do to you when you hear that sort of speech? What does it do to you when you hear critical speech in your home? What does it do to your kids when they hear that type of speech? That sort of types of speech, is it conducive to peace and harmony in this world? To actually to show how we can live with each other. So as actually parents, you should be very careful the way you speak and what you speak. Is it going to be conducive to peace and harmony, to freedom, to growth, to love? And so some of the speech we should use, we should be very, very careful. And when we use speech carefully, we can create a lot of that peace and that harmony in the world. And you make that speech, no one else. So you're in control of this. You're creating your world. You're creating your family. It's not your wife's fault. It's not your husband's fault. It's not your parents' fault. It's not your history's fault. It's your fault. So you take hold of your life. Take responsibility for it. Empower yourself and say that you can do anything with what you have. And it is heaps and heaps of stories of people in the most difficult of situations. People who have, you know, been raped, people who have had their children sexually abused, people who have had these cancers, who've lost their children through accidents, whatever it is which happened, that they have stopped complaining, they've taken control of their lives, they've empowered themselves, they've understood the law of karma, is that you make suffering. No one else makes it for you. And we can actually change and use our thoughts, our speech, our actions to create a better world for ourselves and then a better world for others. And of course, one of those right views is like the law of forgiveness. Everyone is an owner of their own karma. So why do we take on the stupidity of others and worry about it ourselves? Doesn't matter what your husband said. If he was really stupid, that's his karma. You don't have to make bad karma for yourself with it by arguing back. If your wife has really been lazy, that's her karma. You don't need to make bad karma with it. So as I, as a monk, as a teacher in our monastery, if my monks misbehave, that's there. I'm not going to lose sleep over that. I don't get enough beauty sleep as it is. So the point is, you don't carry around the faults of other people in your own heart. You'd be able to let them go. Why is it that people are just so attached to the thoughts and actions of others? One of the first teachings I got from Ajahn Chah was, in the monastery, monastic life anyway, you should look at yourself 95% of the time and only look at other people 5% of the time, at most. And that's actually a wonderful right view. So don't look at what the other person is doing or saying so much, or thinking. Look at what you're doing, and seeing if you can create a more peaceful, harmonious world, with understanding what is our responsibility, our karma. The person who wrote the email was actually asking, well, is it actually right view understanding cause and effect? Precisely. When you understand cause and effect, we understand like the rules of the game, the rules of life. Now, why do these things happen to me? People keep asking. And when you actually use a bit of mindfulness, a bit of reflection, a bit of clarity, you see why they happen to you. It's the result of your karma. And if we can only see that, we can understand, right, this is what's happening. The karma of the past creates the present reality of now. The karma which I'm making now, the way I react to these situations, is how I'm going to be creating the peace or the turmoil of my future. So it's what we're always doing now becomes the most important thing. This is the result of some cause and effect process. But how I react, and that is what's going to happen in the future. That's how I'm going to create my future. The story which is the most powerful one, which illustrates this, is the story of that soldier in Thailand, a disciple of Ajahn Chah, who came to see Ajahn Chah one day because he'd been shot and wounded in a skirmish on the borders. So he wanted to find out, why have I got such bad luck? I've got this terrible injury. What karma have I done in the past that I've been shot like this? And Ajahn Chah, with his great wisdom, looked into his past and saw the karmic cause of that injury. He said it was because you joined the army. That's what happens when you join the army. You shoot bullets at other people, and other people shoot bullets at you. Sometimes you miss, sometimes you hit. Sometimes they miss, sometimes they hit. Now you've been hit. That's the karmic cause because you joined up. And that's a beautiful understanding of cause and effect. Because sometimes you say, why have I got all these arguments in my marriage? Because you got married. It's part of the course. If you're a marriage counsellor or a monk, which is the same thing sometimes, you just know every marriage is like that. So you think sometimes the next one will be different. Very funny. But the point is that when you're going to have two people living close together, there'll always be friction. when you join an army, there'll always be some bullets, and some of those will be hit. Whenever you're a human being or you have like you're a religious person, people are going to sometimes criticize you. Welcome to real life. So we never think that something is wrong, that these things are happening. I expect there'll be cartoons about Buddhism, which are quite mean and misunderstanding or whatever, but that's life. And look at me, just how many things which I say. It's not just talks here, just go to New Zealand, give talks, go to Indonesia, give talks, Singapore, wherever I go, I give talks. I open my mouth so often. It's only the law of probability. Sometimes I'm going to say something which offends somebody. I just can't help it. But the point is that if ever you're offended by anything which I say, don't allow yourself to be offended. Because why is it that people just they give up the beautiful teachings because I'm say a stupid joke or whatever? That's my big weakness, my jokes. And they're just like cartoons, make a cartoon, somebody will be offended. Fortunately, I'm in a religion where people don't try and blow me up afterwards. So I'd hate to be sort of, a teacher of another religion. I'll be dead by now. There's jokes which I've said. But the point is, well, don't be offended. And if some people don't get upset at you don't need to feel bad about that because that's par for the course. There's not one human being in this world which doesn't get criticized for making a mistake. One of the wonderful things about Buddhism, one of the wonderful right views, is it's all right to make a mistake. We're human beings. That's what we're here for, to learn. Perhaps it was because I was a school teacher that I understood like how education works, and I look very often at this life in the paradigm as an education experience. We're here in this human existence to learn, to grow. And a school has to allow children to make mistakes. And if they never made mistakes on the test would be too easy. And the teacher wouldn't have actually pitched the test to questions at the right level. And the idea is actually to test people, make mistakes, to learn, to grow. Now, if you never made any mistakes in life, then you're missing out on growth. It's from mistakes where we learn, where we grow, become better human beings. So we expect people to make mistakes. And what a wonderful thing it is to allow yourself to make mistakes. And don't feel so bad about it. Number one, it means you don't hide the mistake, you're not in denial. Remember, some time ago, I asked people, is there anyone in this room who is perfect? It's amazing how many people put their hand up. It's just in complete denial, egotistic, arrogant, good for nothings. There's no one in this world is perfect, not even a Buddha was. Sometimes even a Buddha made mistakes sometimes. And this is a wonderful thing to see that you can make mistakes, worldly mistakes, and you can forgive. What a beautiful thing forgiveness is. And if we can have the right view of forgiveness, what it means is we acknowledge everybody is learning. And we can acknowledge that, sure, mistakes are made, but there's something else which is happening at the same time. We never allow the mistakes to hide the wonderful things which are happening. We keep everything in perspective, as in that simile of the brick wall. Never destroy a wall because of two bad bricks. There's 998 good bricks there as well. Now, you know that story because I've said that many times. Now, that is right view, a very good example of right view. Why is it right view? Because it really focuses on on the reality of our lives. We understand the reason why, the karmic reason why we make two bad bricks is because if you lay 1,000 bricks, is one or two bricks have to be wrong. That's par for the course. And number two, we can forgive the two bad bricks because we can see the beautiful bricks as well. We see real life, and we're in control. We can do that. We can embrace and accept, and it leads to peace. It leads to forgiveness, to compassion, this wonderful embracing of life as it is. So that's why it's right view. It leads to peace and harmony in this world. So This is a law of karma. We also understand one of the other reasons, the other teachings of rebirth, of right view, is rebirth. That's a fundamental teaching, reincarnation. It means you always got another chance. If you stuff up this life, don't worry, you can have another go next time round. It would be a terrible thing, I think, if you only had one go at life. Because many of you, if you're especially over 40 or 50, you think, oh my goodness, is this it? You're already over the hill, you're on the way out. Oh my goodness, where's it all gone? Isn't it wonderful? You can have another try. You get sort of like another ticket to, you know, go around again. But also it means, understands that the process of learning, of actually becoming a full human being who understands the nature of life and who can create peace and freedom in their own heart, is not something which you can just do in one lifetime. It's just too much to learn, just too much to understand. And it's a beautiful freeing view which gives you a bigger picture, more chance, more time, more freedom to grow. So even just that idea of rebirth, you can always start again. The wonderful thing of life, from forgiveness, is the ability to start again, do it again, maybe this time better. That's what we call growth. And that's why I love that teaching of rebirth. It means that you can always have another try. Doesn't matter how many times you fail, you can always get up and try again. Fail, try again, keep on going. Because I know from my own experience in life, doesn't matter how many times you fail, as long as you never give up, you must always succeed. It's those people who give up are the ones who don't attain. Just the whole story of building up the Buddhist Society of Western Australia or our monasteries. There's always huge obstacles to these things. And I remember people telling me that when we first started, they thought we'd never survive. You know, our first little house in North Perth? I remember looking at the accounts just when I came. And it was worth, I think, $50,000. And that was our whole assets. And the mortgage was $49,000 we owned. Our equity was $1,000. And we hadn't even just beginning. So it was just completely hopeless. And many people thought we were crazy. Building a monastery in this remote city called Perth, you never do it. But of course, every time you had an obstacle, you never gave up. You kept on going. You kept on rebirthing, if you like. Every time you pick yourself up and try again, we had the problem with our clay trucks. Don't know how many court cases we lost, but we kept on going. That's how we won in the end. So the idea of reincarnation is you've always got more chances, an infinity of chances, which means you can never give up. You just keep on going. Now that is what leads to peace and freedom. Not only you realize you've got as many chances as you want, you can also give as many chances to other people as well. Doesn't matter how many times a person has cheated you, you can still trust them again. That's like reincarnation, giving them another chance, giving yourself another chance, giving your children another chance. It's a wonderful thing about Buddha's forgiveness. There's nothing which you cannot forgive, and there's not a limited number of times that you should forgive. There's something idealistic, uplifting about that. And don't tell me it's not practical, because it is practical. It works much better than keeping resentment, anger. What was that little story about those two prisoners of war? Ex-prisoners of war. These two Aussies who were in the Second World War, and both were interned by the Japanese. And when they met at a reunion, one said to the other, "Have you forgiven the Japanese for what they did to us and our friends?" One of these old diggers said, "No, I can never forgive them. What I saw, what they did, never. What about you?" The other old Australian soldier said, "I forgave them years ago. You, my friend, are still in a prison of war camp because you have yet to forgive." It's a powerful little dialogue. Until you forgive, you're still back there being tortured by whatever happened to you. Wonderful thing about Buddhism, we can forgive simply because we understood each one of us owns our karma. I don't own my torturous karma. I only own my karma. And if I forgive, I own that forgiveness and the freedom which comes from it. I own that peace. You own what you make. You don't own what other people make. Your salary which goes into the bank is what you own. You don't own what I earn. Fortunately, because I don't get paid. So this is what we mean by some of right view, understanding the cause and effect. One of the great reasons why you come to places like this is because coming to places like this where you listen to Dhamma, you understand more about the cause and effect nature. Now, what you have to do, the attitudes which you develop, the way you think, just your whole framework of life, you understand the causes which give these wonderful effects of peace, freedom, and happiness. And you understand that the causes, you don't have to be the person with all the degrees. You don't have to be the person with so much money. You don't have to be the beautiful or the ugly or in between. You don't have to be any of these things to be happy. The cause of happiness is independent of those things which many people in the world think are necessary for peace and happiness. You find that the causes for these wonderful things which you really want in life are nothing to do with what you have outside. The causes for happiness, for peace, a right view which creates that peace and happiness in your life is seeing how things happen inside of you. That's why the Buddhism has always focused on the meditation. To be able to have that inner clarity, to be able to reflect upon how your mind works, so you actually see the causes and its effects. How if you really do get negative, that causes the stress, that causes the sickness, that causes the early death in your life. Simply because of the negativity which you carry in your mind because you can't let go, you can't forgive. You can see where frustration comes from just because of the exercise of will, of being a control freak. It becomes very clear that the more of a control freak you are, the more you try and direct your life and the people around you, eventually you get to frustration because people won't do the things they're supposed to do. And the world won't go in the way it should go. The planes will not leave on time. That's what I found anyway. You know, I read all these itineraries and your plane is supposed to leave at a certain time. It never does. It's always late. Pretty much so. So things never happen the way they should. This Buddhist society. Now, the Buddhist society doesn't run the way it should. We should have an air conditioner in here. Ajahn Brahm should finish on the right time. We should actually tell the right date of our AGM. The computer should never crash. We put a lot of money in those computers. All these sorts of things. Why do you get frustrated? It's because of unrealistic expectations. Basically, willpower. You think that you are in charge of your life and its destiny. The more of a control freak you are, the quicker you get frustrated when the world doesn't go according to your schedules. And the more you get frustrated, the more angry you get. And the more angry you get, just the sooner you die. It all comes from just being a control freak. So one of the wonderful things about the right view of Buddhism is understanding where does suffering come from? Suffering comes from craving. Four Noble Truths, one of the basic forms of right view. It's a great little thing to actually to contemplate. Every time that you have suffering in your life, why is it? Don't just take suffering on board without investigating its cause, the great why question. And it's always because I want things to be different. I always want to give the best talks. I always want to be the best monk. I always want to be the best this or no, the successful one, whatever. It's all craving stuff. And you realize you can't be the best monk. You can't be the best meditator. And it's wonderful to think, at last, I don't need to be the best monk anymore. I don't need to be the best meditator. I don't need to be the most beautiful girl. I don't need to be just the person who never offends anybody. I don't need to be the one who always tells jokes and people always laugh. So you never laugh then. And it's great to have that freedom. It's a freedom caused by having not so many expectations, not so many desires, not to be such a control freak. It's always understanding the right view, sort of, you know, of craving causes suffering, and the wonderful right view of anatta. Anatta means there's no owner in here, that you don't own your body, you don't own your wife, your husband, you don't own your children, you don't even own your car, your house, you don't own your health. It's a wonderful freeing right view, because what you don't own, you don't need to worry about so much. When I was staying in Wellington in New Zealand, I don't own that monastery. It's not my monastery. I'm not the abbot there. Way! I don't need to worry about anything. Same here. Got an AGM tomorrow. But I don't own this Buddhist society. Hey, whatever happens, it'll be okay. My monastery down at Serpentine, I don't own that. Hey, whatever people do, I can be free. Whenever you think you own something, you have this false idea of responsibility that you are in control, and if things go wrong, you are responsible. That's called suffering. The wonderful right view is what releases you from that suffering, from that burden. And the great teaching of anatta is that you don't own anything. Everything which you think is yours will one day become separated from you. That's one of the great teachings, almost verbatim from the Buddha. All that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will one day become separated from me. So was it really mine in the first place? Was this really my body? Or just a vehicle which I had to live in for, you know, so many years? So when this gets cancer or it gets heart attack, am I worried it's got cancer? No, just cancer, that's all. What's the big deal? It's not mine. Not my problem. Is it? Or if you're getting old and about to die, is that really your problem? If your children sort of, you know, they marry the wrong person, is that your problem? It's their problem. They chose that guy. And off you go. Now the point is here that when we own things, then we make our problems. And in the ownership, you should know by now that you don't own these things. The right view is to understand how little you really own and control in this world. You don't own your reputation. You don't own the comments and opinions of others. They say whatever they like, whether it's true or false, you can't stop them. When you understand this beautiful non-ownership, that's one of the greatest of right views. It means that you have these things, you look after them, but you don't demand much of them at all. You're just like a person passing through. You make use of this body, as you make use of a house that you are renting, or a room where you're staying in temporarily on some great journey through this planet. But you know it's not mine. When it's not mine, you don't get attached to it. You enjoy and then let go. When you have a partner in life, you enjoy their company as long as they are there. But when the parting happens, which it must, you can allow it to disappear. It's not mine. I can't control it. I have to let it go. and letting it go is the third part of right view. Understanding. It is impermanent. Things don't last. It's the nature of life to be that way. Things come and things go. And your job, when you understand the great impermanence, the instability of our lives, is when it's time to let it go. You can let it go, and you can flow with the impermanence, the rise and fall, the change of our lives. You don't try to be always young. You can enjoy middle age, an old age, an extreme old age. And is it a wonderful freedom not to be afraid of being old? Not to be afraid of being sick? A lot of sickness comes from being afraid of being sick. The fear creates a tension. The tension causes many illnesses. So if we can stop controlling more, understand that we have to flow with the rise and fall, which is impermanence. We're not in control anyway. And that the suffering all comes from controlling things which we aren't really ours. And where we let go and detach more and more, because it's a beautiful freedom. And that freedom we can experience in our meditation, we can experience in our lives. The freedom which doesn't hold. The freedom which can hear the opinions of others and then drop them immediately. Which is never offended, because it's words which come up. Often say, if someone calls you an idiot, the only reason you get offended is because you start thinking they may be right. If you realize from the outset they are wrong, you can never be offended. So if you... when we don't own the words, we allow them to just flow through in one ear and out the other, as they say. If they're good words, we can keep them. If they're bad words, we can let them all through. Instead of just keeping the bad words and forgetting the good words. We can actually learn how to let go of life. Learn how to flow with its impermanence, with its change. Not to demand what life can give us. We understand the cause and effect process. And understand that we can give another chance every day. We can understand rebirth, karma, cause and effect, the impermanent suffering and non-self. And thereby, that should be a path to peace, to freedom, and to harmony. And if it is, it really is right view. If it leads to a sense of being irresponsible, lazy, then you're taking letting go too far. You know what I was saying this when Buddhists in New Zealand sometimes are trying to keep the five precepts and they went to parties and say, no, I'm not taking any alcohol, I'm a Buddhist. And their friends told them, yeah, we know about Buddhism, it's all about not being attached. Let go, come on, let go, take some alcohol. Obviously, that's not understanding what letting go is. Because it's not leading to peace and to freedom and to sort of happiness. So understand what right view is. They have the traditional areas of right view. Karma, cause and effect. Not sort of holding other people's karma in your own heart. You're just responsible for your actions. So it means you can forgive, you can let go what other people do. Your responsibility is what you do, your karma. And rebirth, we can always give another person another chance, give yourself another chance. Understanding the cause and effect, and understanding about the more we control, the more we suffer. And the more we understand impermanence, the more that we can flow with things, and the more that we can understand we don't own things. The more detached, the more free we can be. And that must be right for you, because that does lead to peace, to harmony, and to freedom. So may you all be peaceful, harmonious, and free, ever and ever and ever. I've done my job now. Now it's up to you.